Welcome to Race and Democracy, a podcast on the intersection between race, democracy, public policy, social justice, and citizenship. Okay, on today's episode of Race and Democracy, I am honored to be in conversation with Dr. Nell Irvin Painter, Edwards Professor of American History, Emerita at Princeton University, who's really an icon nationally and globally. She's the best-selling author of the New York Times bestseller, The History of White People, Sojourner Truth, A Life, A Symbol, and the National Book Critics Circle Award finalist, Old in Art School, A Memoir of Starting Over. A fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences since 2007, she has received honorary degrees from Yale, Wesleyan, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and Dartmouth. After earning a PhD in history from Harvard, she also completed degrees in painting from Mason Gross School of the Arts at Rutgers and the Rhode Island School of Design, RISD, as we called it. Painter lives and works in East Orange, New Jersey, and has made artist books in residencies such as McDowell, Yaddo, U-Cross, and Bogliasco.
Bogliasco.
Yeah. She currently serves as Madam Chairman of McDowell. Okay. Nell Irvin Painter, welcome to Race and Democracy.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
I really, really enjoyed this book, I Just Keep Talking, A Life in Essays. And I would start by saying I first read your work in graduate school. My advisor was the late Kenneth Kuzmer, and we did read both Exodusters and
really?
Standing at Armageddon.
Yes, good.
So I've been familiar with your work since the days of graduate school in Philadelphia in the 1990s. I started graduate school in 1993 and continued to follow your work, love the history of white people, and love the art book that you created, which we have right here, Creating Black America, African American History and Its Meaning, 1619 to the Present, that I've used and cite in my courses and in my latest book. This book, I Just Keep Talking, A Life in Essays, is not just a collection of different essays that you've done on visual culture, whiteness, Southern history, biography, but it really, autobiography and biography, but it really is personal too. I love the introduction. Very, very moved by the introduction. As somebody who lost my mother 2 years ago, I was very, very moved. So this ego histoire in the introduction, I'd love to start there because so many of us who are scholars know you as really a towering historian of post-Civil War America, Exodusters, the narrative of Hosea Hudson, Standing at Armageddon, Sojourner Truth, The History of White People, just many, many others, and many, many dozens and dozens of essays. But you're also an artist, a very accomplished visual artist.
Thank you.
So I'd like to start there because you start with your essay here, It's a Good Thing That You Didn't Die Young.
Yes. And
so let's start with that.
Yeah. I say it's a good thing I didn't die young, partly because of art school, actually, where living fast and furiously and dying young is okay. And in the introduction to Old in Art School, I actually talk about it's too late for me to die young in terms of my art. But in terms of our historical scholarship, if I had died young, I would have missed your work, for instance, which would have been a hardship. And I would have missed the ability of readers and my historical peers, my scholarly peers, to see my work. Because when I got my PhD in 1974, which is in the 20th century, in the 20th century, as I look back on it, the whole 20th century is very comfortable being white supremacist. So what year did you get your PhD?
2000.
So in 2000, already, even though you may have felt dismissed or not appreciated, or that people were not reading your work with their eyes open, you may have felt disregarded. Mm-hmm. It was 1,000 times more in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And already in the 70s, it was better for me than it was for, say, the esteemed John Hope Franklin.
Who you talk about a lot. Yeah.
I mean, John Hope Franklin was practically treated like a freak by the historical profession. Mm-hmm. The year that he spoke at the Southern Historical Association, I think he was the first black historian to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, people were packing the room and hanging off the windows because it was just undone. It was not, they couldn't believe it. I mean, imagine the pressure of being a historian in a world that didn't believe you could exist. Mm-hmm. So John Hope Franklin also got his PhD at Harvard, as did W.E.B. Du Bois and Carter Woodson. And the 20th century scholars, their work didn't get read in the way that it should and in the way that it can be now, mm-hmm. in the 21st century. And you probably feel differences between the time that you got your degree and the reception that your students receive for their work.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen the difference in the transformation. Although it's, as we discuss, it'll be interesting, like, in 5-10 years, what do we say because of the kind,
yes,
the context,
because
and backlash.
Of the backlash right, mm-hmm. now. And my heart is broken right now because I see the anti-woke, anti-DEI is simply a call for resegregation.
Absolutely.
But on the other hand, I also see some teeny, weeny, weeny, weeny intimations that I'm not the only one, and we Americans of color are not the only ones who understand that and are likely to be even more careful about being inclusive.
Absolutely.
That may happen.
You say here in your introduction, my blackness celebrates itself through art, music, dance, painting, talking, writing.
Whatever black people do.
Yes, what I term black studies. I love that. And I want us to start at the beginning with the introduction where you talk about your lineage, your parents, your grandparents. Mm-hmm. You talk about being born in the Houston Hospital for Colored.
No, for Negroes.
For Negroes.
Capital
N. Negroes,
N.
Capital N.
Yeah.
And your mother went from Prairie View to what is now Texas Southern, but it was the
Houston College for Negroes.
For Negroes, yeah. For Negroes as well. Mm-hmm. So let's talk there. And you talk about you weren't meant to be a Southerner. You,
that's right.
You grew up in the Bay Area,
yeah.
And end up going to Berkeley. But let's talk about what do those beginnings mean for you? Like when you're recounting those beginnings and really how, even though you were born in an age of racial segregation, the year you're born during World War II, there's also sort of a freedom surge, and there's movements and migrations,
yeah,
happening.
And my parents were part of the migration. So I grew up in Oakland. And I would not have wanted to grow up in Texas. No.
Even though you have Texas roots, and we're talking right here in Austin,
my
Texas.
My Texas roots are 10 weeks old.
Okay.
I left when I was 10 weeks old.
Yes.
And I came here yesterday, and yesterday is at some point I was looking at my phone at the news, and I see that the Texas legislature wants to devote $1 billion to vouchers to basically destroy the public schools. That would not happen in California.
Yes.
And that's one of the reasons I'm glad I don't live here. You ask about my background. we were relatively educated. My parents met in college. My mother's father was a college professor. Mm-hmm. My father's father was a skilled mechanic in the railroad. Mm-hmm. So they were, I didn't grow up in want. I didn't grow up in the kind of family that is kind of the quintessential 20th century Black family, mm-hmm. especially Southern Black family. So I didn't grow up in want. I didn't grow up in violence. And I also grew up in a very left-wing household. And I think the two sides of that are almost equally important, because I didn't grow up believing that the United States was this wonderful place. I grew up with a kind of skepticism about the beliefs of American exceptionalism. Mm-hmm. My parents were not communists, but we knew communists. And when people ask me, you know, what do I remember reading as a child, I remember Winnie the Pooh, I remember Felix the Bull, and I remember the novels of Howard Fast.
Wow. And so you talk about you didn't have a bunch of trauma, but your older brother passed away.
That is a very personal trauma, and I still cannot understand how my parents survived that.
But they said they survived it. We had you.
No. Yeah, but that's not enough. I've just been listening to a book about religion from my Princeton colleague, Pagels, Elaine Pagels. And she lost a child and then shortly afterwards her husband. Mm. And she talks at length about grief. Mm-hmm. And I know my parents must have felt that grief. Mm-hmm. But somehow they managed. Mm-hmm. I don't understand. I'm very grateful to them. At a later moment, my father suffered from depression for decades, I guess I would say, in his maturity. And at one point, electroshock treatment was the only thing that really made a difference. Mm-hmm. And he was in what they call geropsych, mm-hmm. the psychological part for old people. Mm-hmm. And they were going to, he was at, I think, Highland Hospital. And he said, I can't stay here. And I heard something that I had never heard before, is that's where my brother died. Mm. I didn't know that. And maybe the way they dealt with it was not to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Especially from that generation.
Yeah.
So in Oakland, you were part of the same class, different tracks, of course, Huey
yeah,
Newton.
Yeah, that's right. So handsome.
So, wow, it's so interesting. So you experience so much history. You're at Berkeley. You're connected to the Afro-American Association and Donald Warden, which is a very early Black nationalist group.
Yeah, it was a Black Studies.
Black Studies group. Mm-hmm. So how was that, those experiences? Because I want to talk about those before, you know, going to France, Africa.
Sure, When we think about Don Warden and even the Panthers, and I even went to the Nation of Islam because, you know, my friends were attracted. And one of my friends who, as of last year, thank God, was still alive, stayed with it. But for all of those organizations, those institutions, usually the talk about them ignores two things. One, incredibly sexist. The misogyny is just right in there.
Okay.
And the other thing is class.
Okay.
They just assumed that people were coming from trauma and want. And dealing with trauma and want were a large part of their strength and their message. Mm-hmm. I respect that. But that didn't pull me in.
No. And it's interesting, you have the great anecdote about the great E. Franklin Frazier being a friend of the family, and you had every intention to go to Howard University, the Mecca. And he said, what did he say to you?
He said, "Nell, Irvin, sit down." He had come to our house for dinner. And I had said, "Oh, Professor Frazier, I'm going to go to," because I had gone, you know, I was all the smart kid. I was always the only black kid. And I just was tired of that. And so I was telling him that I was going to Howard. I was very proud of that. I was looking forward to it. And he said, "Nell Irvin, sit down." He said, "You are too smart and too dark to go to Howard."
And I find that—
And he was right.
But I find that really interesting from my eyes. So I grew up in New York City. And when I look at your— and you say it throughout the intro, you talk about being dark-skinned. In New York, we wouldn't— your complexion, in fact, as somebody who grew up around Nation of Islam and Five Percenters, they would call you wisdom-skinned, which is a kind of—
I never heard that before.
Wisdom-skinned from New York City. Yeah. It's a kind of— it's almost a café au lait. I mean, I don't think of you as
café au lait. No,
was a brown, a cinnamon. It's not.
I did not grow up in a West Indian family. I actually spent a lost year in Trinidad. I don't tell many people that, so don't share it. But I must say, I have never understood how those people, they have such teeny weeny just layers and ways of talking about all— I'm sure Haitians have it too.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just how light or dark you are, but, you know, what is your nose? What are your eyes? Mm-hmm. What are your lips? Are you leaning towards red? Are you leaning— I mean, all these gradations. Mm-hmm. I didn't grow up with that.
Okay.
I just grew up with light and dark, basically.
Okay. Okay. And light was people who were very,
light was
very...
my father, okay. And dark was my mother.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you talk about Ghana and Ghana changing your life.
Yeah.
And you were there for 2 years.
Yes.
From 64 to 66.
Yes.
So I'd love for you to talk about that because, one, you were able to see Malcolm X in person.
I was.
And 64.
Also, Kwame Nkrumah.
Kwame Nkrumah. This is amazing.
And Maya Angelou.
Yeah. So how was— you talk about Ghana making you feel ordinary, but in a great way.
In a good way.
Yes.
Yes. It was a letting down of burdens, really. And since my family, we were at the university. My father was chief technician of chemistry at the university, which was his position at the University of California. He just moved over. So we didn't have any class burdens. But also, since my father was at the university, we had known African students beforehand.
And tell us what university, because I've been to Ghana and I've been to Legon and the—
That's the University of Ghana.
Yeah. And how beautiful that is.
Well, yes, it was very— it's probably still very beautiful.
Yes,
though the pictures I see of Ghana now, you know, it's so developed. And,
yeah.
But at any rate, it was very beautiful. It was very comfortable. It was very nice. I forgot what I was telling you, though.
About how it made you feel ordinary, but in a good
way. Right. I didn't have to be the black person. Now, since we had known African students, and I don't think we knew African faculty. I don't think, no. But we knew African people.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't, and also being left, we didn't have any sort of ideas about Africa as the promised land or Africans as our brothers and sisters, or, oh, we're going home. You know, we didn't go with that kind
of romantic
mindset.
Notions.
That's right. Okay. That's right. We were there to build African socialism.
Really? And who did you meet there? I mean, you talk about Preston Lee and certain people.
Preston, I was just thinking about Preston. He's still alive. Preston. I didn't meet David Lewis. He had left.
One year.
But Preston, what is Preston's name?
Did you meet Les Lacy or
I did.
Julian Mayfield?
Yes. I knew Leslie Lacy, broke my heart.
Really?
Julian Mayfield was a little older and married. He was kind of the father figure
yes.
Of the African-American socialists.
Rosa Gee and Sarah Wright were there, maybe?
They were there. I didn't know them well. I was very young at that time, and I think they kind of didn't take me seriously. No, it's not that I think. I know they didn't take me seriously.
Was Maya Angelou there?
Maya was there, yes. Okay. And I knew Maya pretty well, and we stayed in touch over the years. So, you know, when I taught in the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, she was at Wake Forest, and I visited her. We actually made a video at her house there. And then when she left, she ended up in Oakland, and we visited in Oakland. I was just rereading a sliver of my own journals where my mother and I visited Maya and Ruth, another great Oaklander. And let's see, they were saying how much they like the Hosea Hudson book. And they were talking about DECA.
That's a good segue with the Hosea Hudson, because you started out studying African history.
Yes.
And you become a student and scholar of American history.
Yes.
But even before this, you are also interested in art. So I want to talk about how you said here in this introduction to I Just Keep Talking that you didn't necessarily see models.
That's right. I didn't know how to be an artist.
You're doing now, so you do later
but this,
in life.
This is again part of the change over time, because when I was in high school, I took drawing classes at California College of Arts and Crafts with a wonderful printmaker now named Margot Humphrey. Margot Humphrey was 8 times the artist that I was, and she stayed in art, and she taught for many years at the University of Maryland, and finally had a monograph about her and her art, and I think even a New York show. But it was like 50, 60 years later. And if you look at the art history of the artists, the women artists, the Black women artists of my generation, they were completely ignored.
Yeah.
And if I had stayed in art, I would have been completely ignored. Now, I am not a person of roaring ambition. However, I would like to have my work recognized. And they didn't.
Mm-hmm. It's only now Faith Ringgold and certain people like you've talked
Faith
about.
Faith Ringgold made it by dint of living.
She lived long enough for people to recognize.
She told me stories of how her work was. Well, she wanted to join Spiral, for instance, which Romare Bearden and the colleagues in the 60s, the Black artists in the 60s, mm-hmm. they were all men. They wanted to make their contribution to the civil rights struggle mm-hmm. through art, and through also to encourage each other mm-hmm. and show their work and so forth. So Faith, who was in their generation, said to Romare Bearden, I'd like to join you. And he totally blew her off.
Yeah.
They finally accepted one woman, much younger, way lighter skinned, Emma Amos, marvelous, marvelous artist, mm-hmm. Who was my mentor in art, and whose work graces the first edition cover of Southern History Across the Color Line. So, but they could admit this one woman, young, light.
Well, let's talk about some of your scholarship, and then we'll talk about the evolution. You know, your first book, Exodusters, is really an extraordinary history of Reconstruction and Black mm-hmm. folks who tried to escape the terror, and you say successfully
in
certain ways.
First, they tried to be citizens.
Yeah.
It's a heartbreaking book, mm-hmm. And it has become newly timely
Absolutely.
Unfortunately.
In the wake of January 6th.
And just the backlash, and the use of terrorism.
And you show a quote from the book where it talks about this woman whose husband is murdered by 50 or 60 terrorists.
Yeah.
Really, really.
In a very gruesome way.
In certain ways, in so many ways, I think Exodusters, way before the work of Eric Foner and other people, at least for me, gave a paradigm and an understanding of Reconstruction as something where Black people themselves from the grassroots were redefined. So before a nation under our feet, so and in following in the tradition of Du Bois' Black Reconstruction. So that's what I wanted to say.
And it is a very left-wing book in that way. It's the response to my coming out of African history. One of the things I tell people who ask me, how do you survive? I say, flee. Flee. I was lucky to spend years of my youth outside the United States.
In France and Ghana.
Yeah. And I have never taught summer school. I go away in the summers. I go far away.
I taught it once and never.
I go far away. Yes. Flee. And so my question was, why did Black people stay in the South? You know, since flight is such, to me at that time, such an obvious answer. Mm-hmm. Well, the answer was they finally turned to flight when they couldn't stay. Mm-hmm. And they worked at staying. They worked at being citizens of Louisiana, Texas, and Tennessee. They had no alternative. And then also what I discovered, there wasn't a big historiography about the exodus to Kansas of 1879, but other historians had turned to it. And they had ended up by saying, it was a failure. And I recognized that narrative that what the Black people do must not work out. It must be a failure. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a failure.
No.
They got out.
Yeah. And in Toni Morrison writes about Nicodemus in some of her fiction.
Yeah, in a very different way.
In
Paradise.
When you think about your work, I want to talk about you talked about left influence, but the narrative of Hosea Hudson and this Black communist who, you talk about a Knopf editor turning you down because Hudson didn't tug at one's heartstrings.
Right.
And you write, Hudson, feisty, mouthy, unrepentant communist, certainly did not. And as a reviewer noted, neither do I. Let's talk about both Hosea Hudson, why that's so important, but also your depiction and how you write.
And first I have to thank my parents for letting me know that I didn't have to live up to anything, that I would not be out in the street. Yeah. I would not be in want if whatever I did didn't work out. Mm-hmm. So I was very fortunate in that. And I didn't realize that for a long time. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize, you know, it may sound strange for a Black woman to say I had the privilege, but I did have the privilege of not worrying about my future. Mm-hmm. So I did what I wanted. And I was very interested in Hudson. He was an entrancing character. And he had a good sense of self. He had, in the party, he had learned to read and write. Mm-hmm. He could write, and I reproduce a page of his writing, which actually may look a little bit like Trump's because of the use of capitalization.
Oh, my gosh. That's the first time I'm hearing a comparison between Hosea Hudson and Trump. And that book has been so generative. I mean, I know it was an inspiration for Robin Kelly and Hammer and Ho.
Yeah.
And it's been such an inspiration for really sort of what C.L.R. James calls the self-activity of folks who were part of the party or adjacent on the ground, but in a rural sense. So in certain ways.
No, he wasn't rural.
That's true.
He's very much a city man.
He's very, very much a city man. But in certain ways, that's kind of like I was thinking about the artist, the black artist, Elizabeth Catlett.
Oh, yes.
Who looked at figures from the 1920s, yes. 30s yes. in ways that really ground their humanity. And yes. you did the same thing with Hosea. Yes.
She was my father's favorite artist.
Really?
And he went to Mexico to visit her and came back with a signed print. Which I still have.
Oh, that's extraordinary. Yeah. So your family was just a very sort of bohemian, you know.
Yeah, bohemian is a good word for it, actually. Because, family. You know, I have heard really upper-class black people talk about their parents were doctors and so forth. And they were much, much more advanced socially than I. But... yeah, it was. My father, when we lived, I grew up on 61st and Telegraph in Oakland. Mm-hmm. And my father would ride his bicycle down Telegraph Avenue to the university wearing a beret.
Oh, that is awesome.
My father wore a beret. He smoked a pipe. Yes, he was a bohemian.
Now, you were introduced, or somebody who helped the introduction to Hosea Hudson is the literary scholar, Dr. Nellie Y. McKay.
Yes.
You had a 30-year friendship with her.
We did,
whose work I immensely respect and find inspiring. And you also talk about Thaddeus Davis.
Yes.
Who, 40 years of friendship.
Yeah.
And you dedicated creating.
I think we're farther along now. Nellie is no longer living, but Thaddeus is.
Thaddeus is. So yeah. Over 40 years of friendship. Yeah. How did those friendships with black women who are also scholars and creatives too impact this journey that you've been
yeah.
on?
Well, they kept it from feeling solitary for mm-hmm. and they kept me from feeling like I was losing my mind. And that's something that I think, still have to hear. No, you're not crazy. This mm-hmm. is really happening. And so Nellie and I exchanged letters for all those decades, and part of it was, a lot of it was just, this is what is going on today.
Yeah.
And so in our letters, we didn't have to be correct. We could be honest. Mm-hmm. And we could say things that we wouldn't say in public.
Yeah. And you talk about it. There's an essay later where you're talking about, it's a page and a half where you have a lot of problems getting it out, talking about progress, about like, you know, the progress or the lack thereof for black people in the academy and sort of the frustration.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The frustration.
Yeah, somebody asked me and I said, I can't show up.
The frustration. So you're talking and bonding, mm-hmm. bonding over that. You briefly say that you feel standing at Armageddon didn't get the reception that it deserved. I mean, it's still there with useful AP history courses mm-hmm. in every few years. Mm-hmm. Graduate student or young professor writes me after having just discovered it on their own. Before we get to Sojourner Truth, what do you think that, why do you think standing at Armageddon hasn't, although I was assigned it at,
oh, really?
At Temple University.
Okay.
Yes.
Wonderful.
Yeah. By Ken Kuzmer. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That tells you something about your professor.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
The
late Ken Kuzmer. Yes.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Rest mm-hmm. in peace.
Yeah.
And the easy answer is there wasn't a place in the firmament, for a black woman writing about U.S. history.
Okay.
That's the easy answer.
And you're going to face that again in a complicated way when we get to A History of White People.
Oh, boy.
Because it's a huge public success in a way that
right.
standing at Armageddon was. It's
yeah.
a bestseller.
Yeah.
You're on the Colbert report,
yeah.
which I happen to have been on as well a couple
uh-huh.
years later.
Yeah.
But you started art school at RISD. So there's a kind of celebrity that happens with A History of white people.
Yeah. But a total dud.
But in terms of book prizes,
yeah.
which obviously
yeah.
your
Zero.
Work has merited for decades in terms of the big book prize, mm-hmm. the Pulitzer National Book Award and those things. Let's talk about Sojourner Truth, A Life, A Symbol, because this book, I think it's a remarkable book, and you upend the notion that Sojourner Truth said, ain't I a woman or mm-hmm. aren't I a woman?
I just had a go round with Brett Stevens in the New York Times about that.
Yes, yes. And you say Frances Dana Gage, a white journalist talking back to Harriet Beecher Stowe 12 years after the fact, made up the phrase.
Yeah.
And you have an essay about this. So you talk about how there were certain, women's magazines and different stuff that wouldn't review Sojourner Truth as well. So
yeah. Part just the one.
Just the one. But mm-hmm. part of it, I think it's very interesting in terms of you and your scholarship and the way in which at times mainstream white women or white feminist scholarship perceives your scholarship or mm-hmm. lack of. Mm-hmm. I'd love to get into that because you in that short essay on biography too, you talk about that, the almost the resilience you need in terms of dealing with mainstream feminists. And sort of the elisions and the
it's not just white feminist. I mean, the ideas of what somebody like Sojourner Truth must have been, those notions are very pervasive. And if you just Google Sojourner Truth, you will come across a score of black women standing up saying, "Ain't I a woman?" So it's a phrase that Americans want.
And the stereotypical flattened Sojourner Truth is sort of not very literate. She doesn't speak multiple languages.
She wasn't literate. She only spoke two languages. Okay. Dutch and English. She was not literate, but she was really smart. And she was an entrepreneur in a way. Mm-hmm. She got herself out. She published her book. She sold her book. Mm-hmm. She was a knitter, which I'm writing a new book on Sojourner Truth called Sojourner Truth Was a New Yorker, and She Didn't Say That.
That's a great title.
And it starts, it really focuses on Sojourner Truth, the person. Mm-hmm. At the end, of course, we'll get to a life, a symbol in mm-hmm. a way. Throughout this time, one of the reasons I'm really glad I'm not dead is that I can write, and you can write, and we can write in ways now. We can publish work now in a way that could not be read.
Absolutely.
A generation or two
ago.
We have
to hurry up because of AI. We have to hurry up because they're
I'm not worried about
taking
AI.
All of our intellectual property.
Though they have taken a lot of mine. A whole raft of essays and three books.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. But at any rate, so in the new book, I'm going back and forth between now and her lifetime. But it starts really focusing on her being born. And it's her life as this extraordinary, well, when she's born, she's just a kid, just an enslaved kid in Ulster County. But as she becomes this person, it will be her at every point in her life.
Oh,
it's not
beautiful.
A flattening. It's not, Sojourner Truth was like other black women. No, she was absolutely extraordinary.
Now, I want to talk about a history of whiteness, the history of white people. Really, and then talk about your art and what, mm-hmm. get us to the now. That book comes out in 2010, and it's a real big splash.
Yeah.
I remember seeing you, not just on the Colbert Report, in a lot of spaces.
Yeah, got a lot of
spaces.
Yeah.
And that was very interesting because how did you feel about that? And I want to talk about that, juxtaposing the real celebrity that you get. And by 2010, had you retired from Princeton yet or
yes,
no?
Yes.
You had retired from Princeton.
Yes.
You were going back to art school.
Yeah, I was in my graduate art program.
And I remember you write in I Just Keep Talking that your friends were envious. I remember hearing that you were in art school. So this
yeah.
may, because Dr. Painter is a celebrity among academics, even before she became sort of a celebrity pop culture-wise. And I remember hearing about it and being like, wow, that's so cool. And I remember
exactly.
thinking to myself, especially from the kind of background I came from, where even becoming a professor was almost like buying a pink suit from the life that I led before, because I'm coming from immigrants, Haitian immigrants. So it's kind of like, what's that?
You were supposed to be a doctor.
Or something, but it wasn't tangible. Yeah. I remember thinking to myself, I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the...
Well, I think nearly all of our peers, our scholar peers, didn't know you could do that.
No, I didn't think you could do that. And it's so wonderful to see you doing it. Let's talk about... what did you think about the reception of that, and how did you feel about that reception happening while you were in art school?
It was hard to balance the two because I was promoting the book, but I'm a very hardworking person, and I did my artwork. I produced my paintings. I was tired the whole time, but I think being tired is kind of a fact of life for all of us.
And on some levels, I'm sure you love the success, but you did notice that the book was shut out of awards. And then there's one reviewer, you said a notable historian, who says you don't talk about Franz Boas, and Franz Boas is throughout the
book.
So it's a willful willful misappreciation, willful misunderstanding, willful misreading, or just a not reading of it.
No, a misreading. I think you had to work hard to miss that.
Okay.
I'll never forgive him.
Okay. I completely understand. Very quickly, Creating Black Americans, which comes out in 2006.
Yeah.
This is an extraordinary book, which in the vein of John Hope Franklin's From Slavery to Freedom, tells our story, but it tells it with such brilliant joy and visual art. And I still come back and I cite this book in my new book to this book. I'd never read... African American Studies, Black Studies textbook, like Creating Black Americans. And so what was the impetus behind Creating Black Americans?
I was asked to write it, and I was happy to do so, with the provision that I could have illustrations throughout.
Wow.
And that has been the case. It wasn't the case with The History of White People, which was actually... I think that History of White People was contracted before Creating Black Americans. But in all my books since Creating Black Americans, part of my contract has been the provision of putting images throughout.
Wow.
And every time I say to my editor, I want the images throughout. They say, oh, no, we can't do that. It'll be too expensive. The book will cost $40. Nobody will buy it. We can't do it. But the first place that I really saw that was with Creating Black Americans, where that was part of the creation. But with Olden Art School, which was an independent publisher, they said, yeah, we can do that. This counterpoint in Berkeley. You say, yeah, we can do that. So when it came time for I Just Keep Talking, I said, I want the images throughout. This is Doubleday. And they said, oh, no, we can't do that. It'll be too expensive. And I said, go talk to your graphics people. And they said, oh, yeah, we can do it. And then when I was contracting with Sojourner Truth, was a New Yorker, with Penguin, they said, oh, no, we can't do that. It'll be too expensive. I said, go talk to your graphics people. And they said, yeah, we can do it.
Oh, that's great. That gives me inspiration.
Remember too. That.
I am
going to remember. Go talk to your graphics people.
One of the things I love about this book is all the graphics, but also you give us a clue of your process.
Yeah.
You know, right here in the introduction on page 35, you have photograph of Eastman's studio wall, McDowell. For our listeners, McDowell is a very, very prestigious artist colony. Residency. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the most prestigious in the world. One of a series of process photos of organizing these essays, which I love, biography, Sojourner Truth, autobiography, history, Southern history, whiteness, visual culture. You have something that's deleted. And you write about how now, you know, you talk about how history and art draw on two different kinds of power.
Yeah.
And I want to tap both in this book. So talk about that.
Yes. I think that history is kind of the main... the taproot. In the way that we historians do it, that is using mainly archival print text. But since I got my PhD a million years ago, archives have grown tremendously. Mm-hmm. So we can draw on, we can ask questions that we just couldn't even have thought of mm-hmm. in the 20th century because mm-hmm. the materials are there now. Genealogy, for instance. Archaeology. So historians can ask a lot of questions that they couldn't have asked because the sources were not accessible mm-hmm. at the time. But also what artists can do, artists, myself included, are not tethered to historiographical truth. We can just make it up. We can ask, it's fiction. We can ask all kinds of questions. And historians, including myself, can take those questions back to the sources and enrich history. But the two are not the same.
Okay. My last question has to do with something that's on the first page here, where you talk about, I remember speaking about Olden Art School in Seattle to a wonderful, warm audience, largely of women. A questioner asked me what I do for healing. Nothing, I said. I'm not broken. Not broken, but on occasion frustrated, indignant, self-righteously, pissed off with cause, often exhausted, but mostly and permanently grateful for the people who have protected me, mentored me, supported me over so many decades. Without you, there would be no me. My blackness isn't broken. It faces a different way. Mine is a blackness of solidarity, a community, a connectedness to other people who aren't known personally, of seeing myself as part of other people, other black people. I thought that was beautiful. Can you, in closing, yeah. I think what's so great about this book, but really your work, there's something very humane about it, and there's a connectedness to it that reminds me of James Baldwin. Huh. That reminds me, because as I get older, it's interesting, you write here that John Hope Franklin told you as he got older, he got madder.
Yes.
It's different for me. As I get older, I get more as a father, husband, I get more with my mom passing. I get more, I was crying reading the intro to your
really?
Book. I get more emotional. I get mm-hmm. more able to tap into the humanity
yes.
that I see in everyone, my yes. students, everything
yes.
too.
That's good.
So I want you to talk about that because it's so, you've been through a lot, but you also say my blackness is not broken. I'm
yeah.
part of this larger community
yes.
that you,
yes.
you really connect with. And you can feel it in this book. This
it's
is a
heavy.
Very powerful book.
It's heavy.
You can feel it. My daughter saw me with this book. She said, how are you holding it with one hand? Because I gave it to her to hold. Yes.
Yeah. That is talking back to Afro-pessimism, which seems to be very popular among young black people. And it says that our history is a history of unremitting trauma and violence. And history, the archive, has nothing for us. It is against us. We have to make it up. We have to do wake work as if we are a ship sinking or sunk. And I responded to that almost viscerally as a historian because the archive has all sorts of things for us. And the archive is not something that was cast in stone in the 20th century. Tavolia Glimp, the outgoing president of the American Historical Association, gave a wonderful presidential address last January.
Yeah, which I've read, yes.
Yeah, in which she said, the archives, black people in the archives are shouting, their voices are loud. They are not silenced. And I'm with her on that, but you have to do the work. You can't pretend there's nothing there for you. And I say I say it straightforwardly in my new Sojourner Truth book, that the history of victimization is American history. Black history to me is what Black people have done and made. Mm-hmm. And that's what's creating Black Americans is about.
Wow. Thank you. I've been conversing with Dr. Nell Irvin Painter, the author of many, many books, including a forthcoming book about Sojourner Truth in New York. And her latest work is a New York Times notable book, I Just Keep Talking, A Life in Essays. Many other books, including the best-selling The History of White People, Creating Black Americans, Sojourner Truth, so many more. But it's been so wonderful.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Nell Irvin Painter, Edwards Professor of American History, Emerita, Princeton University, is the author of numerous best-selling books, including The History of White People. And her latest book is I Just Keep Talking, A Life in Essays. She currently serves as Madam Chairman of McDowell. Thanks for listening to this episode. And you can check out related content on Twitter at Peniel Joseph. That's PENIELJOSEPH. And our website, csrd.lbj.utexas.edu. And the Center for Study of Race and Democracy is on Facebook as well. This podcast was recorded at the Liberal Arts Development Studio at the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin. Thank you.